big topic. We are doing researching with children and families, and in particular, undocumented children, marginalized children, preschool children, working with your own children. And this is, again, I'm going to reiterate, this is a live stream. It's been live streamed to many places. We sent the link internationally and nationally. So if you do not want your face or identity known in any ways, please let me know now. Lack of saying I do not want it is giving consent to the process, okay? The comments can be anonymized, you know, and so we encourage people to go online. You can comment if you're worried about, interjecting. This is not a research presentation. What this is people, researchers from various stages, getting together to discuss issues that come up within certain fields and topics. So we have two. At the end of this, we will. So the research issues are research with families, immigrants, marginalized, questions arising from, in particular, ethnographic, co-produced, arts-based research, might be, but not limited to, issues related to sensitive data and research issues, ethics. How do the new EU regulations affect us? Is one of the. At the end, this is not at the first, at the end, we've decided that there will be some presentation on co-produced ethnographic research, arts-based research. Some slides from Kate Paul, who will be coming in November to give an intensive two-day workshop. But first, let me present the two distinguished professors that we have who will be presenting today. I should have practiced this. Also, Palvinen. He's like, no, Okay, I'll tell my Finnish teacher to help me with the pronunciation. She's a professor of in the Swedish department at Jyväskylä University. Her research interests, as you see, multilingual family practices as part of the research field, family language policy discourse analysis, nexus analysis, social linguistics approach to early and bi and multilingual family language policies. Early childhood education and care. She's currently working on a pilot project on single parents, multilingual families, making use of communication technologies to keep contact with significant family members elsewhere. And you're going to be starting a discussion about the issues and concerns and challenges coming to doing with research with children. This our discussant is Sari Goinen, and she's professor of applied linguistics. At the Center for Applied Language Studies in Jyväskylä. Her research focuses on language, language identity, belonging, minorities. She's worked a lot with migrants, refugees, asylum seekers, undocumented children, and her area is not excluding, but focuses a lot on linguistic ethnography, arts-based, collaborative, and co-participatory. And recently she's focusing on the individuals interacting with others and telling their stories that are embedded in wider cultural, political contexts and social structures. Okay, so, now remember, for those who did not attend last time, this again is not a research presentation, so you please feel free to interject at any time. You can. if you have a question, you want a clarification, anything like that, please feel free to interject. This is meant to be an interactive discussion. Okay? Now, I will leave it over to Ilsa. And I'll use the right mouse for the right thing.
So, is it the case that those who are following us in the live stream, can they also ask questions?
Yes, they can.
And
yes, they will be. So what will happen is, oh yes.
How does that work?
So what happens is, and what we had last time was some doctoral students who were unable to attend, and they wrote comments to questions, and I just kind of, at an appropriate time, interject and send this the question out there. So again, these will be done in the future. In June, we're going to do one, and in the fall. So if you are not here or unable to come to the room due to allergies or whatever, you can get online, you can comment.
So how do I get those comments?
I will give them to you.
Okay.
I'm moderating.
Yeah. Okay.
So welcome.
Thank you. No, thank you. And thank you very much, Nadia, and collaborators for inviting me here. I find this very exciting, this kind of forum, because I will be able to talk about things that I haven't really been able to talk about before because of its nature. My name is Åsa, so that's a Swedish name. I'm from Sweden, and Palviainen, I'm married to a Finn, so it's a Finnish last name. And hello also to those of you who are following us from elsewhere. My background is such that I studied and graduated from University of Gothenburg in Sweden. And in the 90s, I worked first as a research assistant and then as a doctoral student in doing L1 language acquisition research. And it was more from a linguistic or psycholinguistic perspective. So we were interested in morphological development, in first language development, semantics, and so on and so forth. And what we did then was to collect audio and video recorded data, audio and video recordings, and we transcribed it and anonymized it and eventually put it on the child's database that anyone can make use of. And was longitudinal studies. Later on, I graduated in 2001. And after that, right after that, we started another type of project. It was about bilingual development in young deaf children who received a cochlear implant. And what we did then was to video record children, these children and their families. The parents were hearing. So we went to their homes to do regular recordings, and then we transcribed it and analyzed it and so on and so forth. Those data were only for the use of the researchers, so it's not open data, so to speak. I did things after that as well, but for this purpose, for this seminar, I would like to mention my latest project, which is called the Child Bilingual Project. It was a 4-year project, and it finished last August. And the name was, the official name is Language Policies and Practices in Bilingual Early Childhood, Swedish-Finnish Bilingual Children in Swedish Medium Preschools in Finland. Did you get that, interpreters? Yeah. So the type of data in that project is also video and audio recordings, field notes. It's an ethnographic project. I won't be talking so much about these earlier projects because they were financed when we applied for the project. We made very clear plans for how to use the data, collect the data, and so on and so forth. And pretty straightforward, I would say. So I wouldn't say that those have raised a lot of questions for me as a researcher. Rather, I will talk about two later projects that I'm currently working on that are of a different type. And that has to do with what Nettie told in the beginning, that I'm interested in family language policy and practices research, and especially the use of technologies in families. Communication technologies, but also how you can learn language by computer gaming, WhatsApp, and that kind of means. So, I try not to talk too much today, but these are the three main themes of my talk. So, the first one is actually from a very interesting presentation given by Srikant Sarangi a week ago. He was talking about ethics and research, and he had a lot of one-liners, very many good things he said. And he said that he asked, can means be acceptable by the ends? And as far as I remember, his answer was a firm no. I have a question mark.
Yeah.
I have put a question mark here because this is something I would like to discuss with you. Positionality and agency. So what's the role of the child and the family in this kind of research? And then the age factor. Does it matter if the child is 2 years of age or 14 years of age? So what I will do is to talk about what I have called extempore research. So that's data collection and projects that have not been, I haven't applied for money to do this, but I've rather discovered that, wow, this is an interesting phenomenon. I want to capture this. So what I've done is to collect data extempore, so along the way. So I don't have these nice EU documents where everything is filled in, signed by, in this case, my son, and so on and so forth. So it's a little bit working on, what is the, yeah. So and this is what I really want to discuss with you today. So the first project, the first of the two ones, is actually about my own son. And that's, of course, the first question. Is it possible to do research on your own family members? The tradition I come from, this L1 language development research, that's quite common to collect data from family members or someone you know. There are very many good things about that, but of course there are also problems. So, is it okay to study your own child? Why I started to collect these data is because he's a bilingual child. Oh, sorry if you didn't see that, was a glass of water falling out on a laptop. Some excitement.
Yeah.
So, in this research project, I call my son Albin. He's bilingual. So I'm a Swedish speaker. His father is a Finnish speaker. So he's a bilingual speaker. What we noticed at a point when he was 8 years of age was that he spoke almost fluent English. And we, as parents, we were very surprised. It actually happened when we invited an English speaker to the family as a guest, and they started to communicate very nicely in English. And I was amazed. I'm a language researcher, still I was amazed. So how did he do this? Because the formal teaching at school hadn't started yet. So he learned English on his own. So we started, I contacted Arja Piiranen-Marsh, who's a professor of English, and who's been doing a lot of research on digital, on computer gaming and language learning. So I contacted her, and we started to collect data together. So this is what we've called a larger ethnographic project. It's longitudinal. We started to follow him at 8 years. He's 11 now, and I would say that I don't collect data anymore. So maybe it was between 8 and 10, the most intense period. So there are a lot of video clips when he is gaming, doing gaming, when he's telling about the games, and it's in Finnish, in Swedish, and in English. We have made quite a lot of interviews with him, collected drawings, field notes, and so on and so forth.
Can I ask, who does the interviews, or is it both of you?
Well, I've been doing these informal interviews. So I should have brought the notebook, where I have written down notes. But Arja came to visit the home on two different occasions, so data point one and data point two. And the thing was that Albin has been aware of that we are doing this data collection. We asked him, we told him that we are very fascinated by your English proficiency. Would you like to tell us about this? Can we record you while you are gaming and so on and so forth? So he was very aware of that we were actually collecting the data. And he was a bit proud that a professor of English was coming to our home to ask him about his gaming. So he felt empowered. This is something I'm good at, and they want to know more about it. So in an ethical point of view, that's maybe a good point that someone, I think Srikant was mentioning this as well, that you are actually empowering your subjects. So she came at 2 points, and here is a ethical, I want to hear what you say about this. But he knew that she was an English speaker. So from that she entered the home, she was speaking English. And the thing is that she and I, we are always speaking English, also at work. So that's our common language. So it wasn't very strange to us. But of course, I know that she's a Finnish speaker. That's her mother tongue. I didn't tell him, he didn't ask me. But I've never told him that she also knows Finnish. So it was actually the language we were using at these two data collection points was English. It wasn't a problem until my husband came home. And he knew that she was a Finnish speaker. So they actually spoke English, but then I noticed this is a really strange situation. So he's kind of pretending that they usually speak English. It was weird. And now he's 11, so I wouldn't dare to go on with this kind of show because it doesn't feel, I'm not honest. So that's one thing that maybe not very ethical. Yeah?
May I ask why was it so important that you talk to, or that Arya speaks English?
We just want, because we recorded these interviews and we wanted to... Yeah, we want to know how well does he manage when it when you're speaking to a native speaker or a native speaker of English. Oh yeah, so the question was why was it important?
Yeah,
that
why
we
was
were
it
speaking?
So important? So you to keep this situation.
So we wanted to see how he managed with an English speaker.
Yeah.
So of course we're also interested in, or we're interested in his language development over this period of time.
Yeah, last time before the catastrophe happened to you, so.
So, why would you say that it was sort of a show? Because, like, I would imagine that this is something that happened naturally. He saw you speak English, he switched into English, or even though they would normally speak in English, but that was just the context.
Yeah, but the thing was that sometimes he knew a word, and Arya knows Swedish as well. And sometimes he wanted to explain something in the gaming videos that they were talking about, and he couldn't remember the English word. So he wanted to say it in Finnish or Swedish, but then he thought she doesn't know Finn English, doesn't know these words. So he asked me, how do you say that in English? And of course that was interesting because it's kind of meta way. Mm-hmm. But it felt bad because, of course, she understood what he was saying to me. So that was a bit weird situation. Do you get it?
No. I think there is, some of us have also, researched, not maybe on their children, but with their children, use them as gatekeepers to children that are in the community, another community. And where's the line between being the show and it being a natural impulse, where does it?
So in this case, when he couldn't find the words in English, so it was natural to ask me, as I was a resource, I could help him to find the words. But on the other hand, it was kind of a show that she had to pretend that she didn't understand what he was trying to find out. So, a little bit tricky. So, he was, Albin has been very enthusiastic all the time to share all his knowledge and so on and so forth. So, it's been really, really nice. Of course, being a parent at the same time as you're a researcher, that's always a bit tricky where to draw the line. But of course, I'm an excellent researcher in this case because I'm there all the time. So I have my notebooks. As soon as he said something really interesting, I went to write down the notes. So it's really rich data that Arya wouldn't be able to collect on her own. But where is the line?
So when you have such a close relationship, there might be less of a fourth wall, as I like to call it, and it drops, and then you have a natural.
Mm. Yeah. And of course, this was very... you can't see this.
Oh,
yeah. So he was, at this time when we started to do the data collection, he was very much, he was playing a game called Growtopia. And this is actually from when we had a sauna together. So he said in Swedish, then, ask anything about it and I will tell you. So he really wanted to tell me. And the thing is, when we started to collect the data, I had to ask him about all these. Who is, what are you doing? Who is this subject? How are you contacting? So I had a lot of questions, which I probably wouldn't have if I didn't collect the data. I would probably just say, as you do when the child starts telling about a computer game. But now I actually ask, so how do you do that? How do you know how to perform, and so on and so forth? So I learned a lot. And I'm a teacher as well, and I noticed that he was practicing a lot on how to define and explain concepts, for instance, gaming concepts, subjects, and so on and so forth. So I was a teacher as well. So he was actually, we have been writing, we just finished an article, Ari and me, and in that one we make a point of that he is the expert and I'm the novice. So he's telling me about his world, this gaming world. Yeah, so this is from the sauna. So can means be acceptable by the ends? Is it okay? For instance, that Arya came and pretended to be an English-only speaker. That's one question to ask, and maybe something for Sari to catch up on. Another thing, when you have this iPhone, it's very, very easy to switch on this recording device. And very many times... no, not yet. Wait, that one. So... For instance, when we were out walking, he had long stories about this Growtopia, blah, 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 blah. And I thought, okay, this is wonderful. So I switched on the iPhone, and I had it, because I always have it on with me. So I was walking with it, and I had the recording device on, and I got beautiful data. But he didn't know that I was doing it. On the other hand, I could have memorized what he said and written down in my notebook. Is there a difference? That's an open question. Because spontaneously you say that the audio recorded data is much more sensitive. But if I actually write down what we talked about, isn't that a similar kind of data?
I mean, I used to do that with a PhD, because I was following Ty around, and a lot of his comments I wrote down like almost immediately.
Mm.
Didn't record them, but I wrote them down. So that is very similar. That
yeah, so what's the difference? Record. Yeah. Sorry.
Would you delete the audio file?
No, I still have it. Yeah.
So maybe is that the sensitivity, maintaining the keeping of that data set versus it comes from your memory here.
But it's also, I'm the parent. So of course you take photos of your child and you want to keep memories. So this is again the borderline between being a parent and a researcher.
What's the difference between that and all those pictures? Yeah. The data got just dispersed to everywhere in the world, kind of thing.
Mm. Yeah.
What if I ask you, would it be any different if he knew that Arya could also speak Finnish? And if he knew that, or if you asked him, like, okay, now I switch it on. Like because you're asking this question without, like, checking whether it would have been different. We don't know that. Like, hey, I'm going to record you now. Please go on or something. I don't know.
Do you mean when Aria was
yeah,
there?
Yeah, yeah. Well, when you were kind of switching on the recording on your iPhone or like making him aware that she also speaks Swedish and English and Finnish.
Mm. I don't actually know what would have happened in that situation.
Yeah, exactly. I was thinking that as parents, it seems we have some kind of unlimited rights over what our the publicity or kind of how we record or make public things of our kids, since it's also always when the institution asks, like the school, they never ask the kid, they ask only you. So you can use whatever you have on your kid without asking the kid. It seems it's just a kind of a family matter. Of course, it does not work the other way. So
I think all of us who have, for instance, Facebook. So do you upload pictures on your children? Some do, some don't.
Yes, but
so it's about ethics and morals.
Yeah. But it's like it's only the parents. Since when the grandparents do, then at least. not many of us are happy with because the grandparents are a bit odd category. So it's us, the parents, who. But if the parent publishes something on Facebook on their kid, then I guess there is no way for the kid to complain on that, since the parent has kind of unlimited power over the kid on these on these issues. Yeah, but still, my daughter is 15, and all the time she brings home those papers whether she can be recorded, and they never ask for her opinion. They are only the parents' consent they ask these forms. So perhaps, I don't know. I haven't seen any forms which ask the. So my daughter is 15, and she all the time, because she performs in different places. So she gets those, brings home those forms, and I haven't seen any forms where they ask for her opinion. But perhaps I don't know. They are all outdated. So, Sari, do you know anything more on this?
I think you're going to say something about that in the comments later, because that's something I'm interested in. Where does it begin and where does it end? This, who is the one deciding on these things? Another thing is also about the time. I mean, if my son is 8, when I'm putting a picture on Facebook, uploading a picture on Facebook, what about in 10 years' time when he discovers that I put pictures of him as an 8-year-old? I mean, it's there, it's out there still. So, of course, if you made the decision when he was 8 years old, it has an effect in the future for him. It might have.
There was a comment that said, I think there's a difference between taking notes and between the recording, that there is his voice and he can be recognized by his voice. I think the new legislation says that when you recognize him and his voice from the recording, that's the difference.
Yeah.
Because you could autonomize his name, my son, or a boy I knew, like they wouldn't necessarily know who that is. But the voice, you could recognize it.
Yeah, and I agree with that. That's probably a very important thing. I'm coming back to this issue concerning pictures in a moment. So Albin, on the one hand, he said that you can ask me anything and you can record me when I'm gaming. But those of you who are from Finland, you will get this point quite quickly. What I did was to record a conversation we had by the dinner table. And after that, he realized that I had put this recorder on, because he was saying such beautiful things. I just put it on. So he asked, Mom, did you record this? And then he said, I don't like it, because I don't always know when you do it. It's one more. So this one. It's like with Axel Smith. And I felt very, very bad. And after that, I stopped doing these recordings. Axel Smith is a VJ, video jockey. He has been leading a lot of entertainment shows on Finnish TV. up to a certain point, because it was discovered. If you click on the picture, because it was discovered that he had put video cameras in his bedroom and recorded when he was having sex with different women without they knowing it. And of course, that's very, very extreme. But the main point that my son had was exactly the same. You're doing this without asking me. And he was 9 years when he said this. And then I felt I blushed, and oh, yes, I realized this is terribly wrong. But then I, of course, lose this observer's paradox. I lose these natural interactions. So I've used quite a lot of time already, so I'll try to be more quick with the second project I have. This started a year ago, in August, as I've been working in this family language policy framework, which typically uses interviews and that kind of data to get what families are actually doing, multilingual families are actually doing. What I wanted to do is to get to know how they use technologies, communication technologies. I got in contact with two families, and I'll just tell you about one of the families. I asked in a Facebook group for people who wanted to participate, and got in contact with this family. So a mother, single-parent mother, living here in Finland, Finnish first language, fluent speaker of English, and some knowledge of Dutch. 4-year-old daughter at home, and the father lives elsewhere in Europe. But they have daily contact using FaceTime. So video, these web calls, daily web calls. So I had a first interview with her just to ask about how they use technologies in this family. And then this timeline, I want to show this timeline because we were together deciding on how to collect the data. I actually asked her, how would you like this to be done? So she started to collect data herself. So I didn't come to visit them. She collected data herself of different types. Diary entries, she made screenshots. And then we met to discuss the data that she had collected. So a stimulated recall session. Then the father came to Finland, so I met him to talk to him. And then I went to a conference in February telling this data. And they asked me, have you visited their home? And actually, I hadn't. So after that, I went to visit their homes. So I think we can continue, because these last ones are about those at-home visits, or actually one home visit. So these are from my field notes, and I took some pictures. And here I really want to rely on the talk by Srikant Sarangi from last week. He was talking about this multi-positional role that the researcher has. You, in a family language, talking too fast. As a family researcher, you're not an outsider, nor an insider. You're a family-like person. Your position is unique when observing a family. In this case, I had multiple positions. I was a researcher. We had similar education and work, so we had that in common, the mother and I. I'm also a parent of a bilingual child. I'm multilingual as this family. I'm a woman, and the mother is a woman. I showed very positive, I was very positive about using communication technologies. Not everyone would, probably, but I was showing a lot of interest. I functioned as a therapist. So she had the mother had a possibility to talk to me about being a single parent. But how much can I show? And now we come to these EU regulations. So these are two pictures. So what's happening here is that the child is lying on the floor. She's watching his father on this iPad. And during this session, she is taking, so the mother put it to the wall, and she's actually standing there, and she's having a spatula in her hand because she's cooking at the same time. And the child is then having the iPad and moving it around, and she's crawling and doing a lot of things while having contact with the father. I can talk a lot about this, but I will just stick to the use of pictures and the fact that I'm intruding their home. What I'm doing here is that I'm sitting on a chair, so I'm actually looking down on the child. I think that if we put a camera on the child's lap, we could actually have her view. So there is the research. The mother is standing there. The father is there. Now I can move farther around. Just that little, that just small thing. When you're an observer, you are actually observing from a certain position. So that's something I would like to continue to think about, to develop my research about, to have it from the child's perspective. And also about these pictures. I knew that this film clip or this seminar might be in a folder somewhere, and the one who has the link can get in and look at it whenever. So I decided, okay, I will blur the faces. Actually, when I went for a conference in the US, I showed the mother the pictures, and she said, this is okay, and no one in the US will know who we are anyway. So this is fine. So this was not blurred in that case. No, I did that. So I don't think you would recognize this child if she was coming, walking towards you somewhere. But what about clothes? What about body postures? What about this marimekko? The home was styled with a lot of marimekko things. But there's so much other things in a picture. It's not only the face. We usually just blur the faces. And I'm really thinking about those of you doing linguistic landscapes, schoolscapes. So if you're having a photo of a poster on the wall, yes, you can't really know where it is from. But if you have ever visited that school, you immediately know which school it is about.
Yeah, how did we, so for example, how did Carrie or you guys do
that? So I guess it's about how, if it's a sensitive kind of a thing there that you have a photograph on, if it's something more or less generic thing. And but of course, if there are names or anything identifiable things, then you blur those in your presentations. And but typically what you have in schoolscapes are not very sensitive things. So,
but who is the one to decide what is sensitive?
Well, I would say we had this issue when we published the special issue, that there was one of the authors who had the opinion that we cannot publish any photos on schools. Yeah. And then, of course, that cannot be the case either. So there has to be some room for common sense in these issues, because if you ask a lawyer, you cannot publish any photos.
Yeah.
Because there is the possibility that you will end up in a lawsuit about the issue. And so it might be it's 1%, but then of course you have to, I guess you can still rely to a certain extent to common sense, that if you see a photo and in this universe it is not a sensitive thing, and you, some of your colleagues and those that are informed in the cultural practices of that region or culture do not think that it's sensitive, then it's not sensitive. That's what you have. In 10 years it might become sensitive, of course, but we cannot be kind of a, then we cannot publish anything.
No, but that's the thing.
Because so the other thing is that
I'm also thinking about this picture. If we think about the way the body posture of the mother or the body posture of the child, if we think that that could actually identify this family, then I should blur even more. And what is left? So that's something I'm worried about with these new regulations. So how much can be anonymized?
I guess the face is clear, because now there are already programs which recognize the face. Mm-hmm. Even on Facebook, there is always, they recognize the faces on photos. So there are programs.
Now you can say to them that
they don't do that if you change the settings. But yeah, so far they have done that.
Yeah, but in practice there are programs.
It was very problematic. So just getting back to this, usually when I show these kind of pictures where there are people doing something and stuff like that, then I use this paintbrush effect.
Yeah, I've done that too. Yeah.
And then it shows the context. You can understand that there's a table, there's somebody lying there, etc. But at the same time, it's so blurry that I wouldn't say that anybody can recognize the exact persons or the exact room, etc. But at the same time, it gives you, especially if it's in color, then it helps more, you know, to understand that
color.
You know what, what's happening there.
And if you go into technical issues, then of course in the future those can be recognized by a program with the blurring of the face. There will be a program which can remove that blurring for sure. It's already there, but so.
But actually, it's not blurring. You just
cut it.
cutted it out or something, or placed something on top of the face. Mm-hmm.
But isn't there a program which can remove that?
Yes, there is. It's called Photoshop.
So I guess the point is that...
On the technical, just on the technical side, there is a whole range of people working on interaction, interaction analysis, on the coordination of speech and gesture, for example. And what they do is they mainly rely on line drawings. And I assume they do their analysis on actual video data, but they will be producing line drawings for coordinating, showing coordination of talk and gesture, and it works. And if it works for such, and this is really fairly detailed, the minute details of interaction. So if it works for that, it should also work for.
What do you mean by line drawings? What do you mean by line?
Just see the contours.
Line drawings of silhouettes.
Yeah.
But in a general, level, the one point is that if you work hard on it, you can recognize the people in most research data. And in some cases, when I have researched, I have looked at papers which are on the same topic, have visited the same village, I can recognize the people, no difficulty. But of course, then you have to kind of trust the colleagues. And in a way, and if there is something really sensitive, somebody killed somebody and didn't tell it to anybody, for instance, then of course it won't be published. So the really sensitive stuff cannot be published at all, which has real threats to people or kind of a real consequences. Because if we recognize those people, so what? So it doesn't bring them to such a light that somebody would like to harm them or whatever. Or I don't know. It doesn't. Does it? What kind of risk does it constitute? So the risk is small, that it would constitute if we recognize those people.
But I wouldn't say that in this case. These are about single-parent households. And when I had an interview with the mother, she said that me and the father, we are at good terms now, so we can do this research. But what if they have a huge conflict?
So if you would be doing that at a safe house, for instance, then you wouldn't be able to publish those photos, I would say.
No.
And those people are hunted by somebody, so they are in safe houses or so they are kind of...
She's in the community and she works with the community.
But I mean that if there is a risk, so if the husband, for instance, hunts those, or if they are living in a safe house, then I wouldn't publish any.
No,
so it's a different.
We don't.
She doesn't speak.
Are partly researchers. And under EU regulations, if that is allowed.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a misinterpretation because you haven't had these regulations yet, and people are making
they do
generalized assumptions.
Already. They
yeah.
are.
Yeah.
They do exist already.
Yeah.
They have been there for 2 years.
Yes.
I follow, but I was saying that you have to consider the risk that there is, and we have the measure, so the measures of secrecy should meet. And certain, if there is a great risk, even though the participant might say that you can publish that, you should consider whether the gains are such. If, for instance, somebody is hounded by another person, whether you publish something that you know that the person who is hounding them might recognize the setting and know from that that, oh, this person is still in Finland. It makes sense to go after her.
Yeah.
So, for instance, then if you... you cannot take into account that somebody... So there are people who are indeed living single mothers who live in safe houses.
Yeah,
also in Jyväskylä. You wouldn't publish anything like this from a safe house, or if you knew that the husband is hounding for them.
But that's extremely
which, yes, but in the single mother context, that I guess also was referring to that the husband is in good terms. So, but of course, in 10 years, the former husband might turn violent, and then, but then of course, in 10 years they might be in different place. So, this won't.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, so
hard to
pretend the future. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
I will try to round up my presentation. We were talking about co-producing data, and in this last project and both these projects, it has been really, really about co-producing data together with the participants. And what happened in this last case was that I visited the family and got a lot of interesting data, and I said to the mother, I leave a camera here. If you feel like it, you can do some filming yourself. You don't have to, but if you want to. And she actually started to do that the following day. And then she emailed me and said, it's problematic because this child Mira, she's asking me, why am I doing this? And she's not natural. And, you know, this is what we are struggling with, the observer's paradox. And I responded to her. I was thinking about these things. How could we solve this? And I responded to her, why don't you give her the camera so that she can film herself? And that was, of course, very exciting to this four-year-old that she could film. So this is, it's very blurry here. So what this actually is the iPad. So Mira is having contact with the father. And in this upper corner, in the upper corner, in this upper corner, you can see Mira holding the camera. So she is filming her father when they are having contact. And this is actually a quote, so she's saying that in English because they communicate in English. Daddy, look, I'm handling it. And of course, this video clip, this was a good moment. But then she just... That's the risk when you give a camera to a child, that you can get whatever.
Yeah.
But it empowered her, so she was part of this. So this is also something I would like to continue to think about, how to use the child as a competent data collector, yes, a co-participant. So I just want to get back to what I started the presentation with. So can means be acceptable by the ends? And how to give this empowerment to the child and the family? And then the age factor, which I mentioned. I hope that Sari will be able to say something about that.
Well, even in the project that I'm presently undertaking, and in the initial pilot project, we're in after-school classes, and they're grades 1 to 6, but we've allowed some preschool kids to come in, so it's the year before grade 1. And there's this little girl, and the refugee filmmaker has come in. He's from Iraq, and he's helping them make the movie. But he's giving them the camera, and he's allowing them to film. And this little girl, and she was filming a newscaster scene, and she kept pushing the stop button like 3 times. But he just was so patient with her. So we were filming the interaction between the filmmaker and the children. And then we're allowing the children to actually create the movie, which is part of the collection.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they have the power, they have the agency, even at such a young age. That's
yeah, sure.
Bad.
Yeah.
Really
yeah. Should
any
I?
Any questions? Any or comments?
I think we should give time to Saria.
So.
Jag hänger den också hit. Vad håller du här? I fickan eller?
Ja.
Unfortunately, I was not able to be in Srikant's lecture. Listening to his words of wisdom, but it seems to be that it was a very interesting and inspiring lecture. Okay, wonderful. I'm not going to talk in detail about my background or anything like that, but just kind of perhaps ask more questions that resonate with what Åsa had in mind and the similar kinds of issues that. Always when you're doing ethnographic research, or especially when you're doing research collaboratively with people who are learning to do research together and whose perspectives are highly important, because otherwise you wouldn't be able to even have your research done. And I entitled this as Colors of Research Ethics, because usually when we are in the Ethics Research Ethics Committee, I'm a member of that in our university. There's a certain discourse that there are no grey zones or grey areas in research ethics. They're only black or white, either do or don't. And you need to make the decisions based on these. And it's very complex. It's always complex, and it's based on compromises as well, but also regulations. And there are certain regulations, and now seems to be some sort of a panic reaction based on this new EU regulation, but nothing very major has really going on. There are certain ground rules that, for example, Petteri called them common sense. I think it's about how we treat people and how we want, if we would be research participants, how we would want us to be treated. So this is perhaps the main topic. I have some books about research ethics, about all the colours, where the coffee table is, and also the regulations. But first of all, there's something that... also pointed out, and this question of can means be acceptable by the ends? I would also say absolutely not. and also being doing research, avoiding doing research with my children, but because I felt that there are other topics, but I wouldn't say that it's not possible and it's not... somehow it would be unethical to do research with your own children. Actually, you would protect more your children when you're doing research. So there's always also this aspect, and especially when you're doing research with your children, it seems to be that you're even more careful, as you also pointed out that in your talk, that you are very concerned about Albin and about Mira as well. this consent comes from the general data protection regulation, and nothing has really changed. You need to have consent. You just can't do anything because science is nice and doing research is interesting. It has to be freely given. People need to have a real choice and control over where they are participating. And especially in longitudinal ethnographic studies, this can be complicated because there are situations when you need to kind of remind, hey, do you remember that I'm doing research? Kind of, is this okay that I record again? Especially with adults, I feel that because sometimes the relationship can turn into a friendship as well. So then, and it's not even a rare case that they might turn into friendships in longitudinal studies, and then even more you need to pay attention to this. It has to be specific, kind of that you would be able to say that why you are doing research, why you are gathering data. And this is about I think it comes from Nuremberg Code from the 40s and the Helsinki Code of Acts. So in order to protect the research participants, and especially in medicine, this has been really important. But it has to be informed. And this has sometimes caused some questions that, does it have to be written? No, it doesn't have to be written. It can be anything. It can be oral, it can be sign language, it can be recorded, it can be anything. It's just sure that it's unambiguous. It's a clear indication. And in a teenage language, it can be whatever. And it's a yes, apparently. You just need to make sure if it's a yes. So if it's a silence, and it says in Finnish, there's a Finnish saying that silence means yes. Not in research, it does not. So if somebody is silent, it's not a clear agreement to take part in the research.
I think this is important to highlight, particularly with children and teenagers who Finnish is not their first language or English is not their first language, because as we know from writing these informed consents, even orally, translation is such a tricky.
Yeah.
Dialect might be different, your language choice, your vocabulary choice, and that can really also the understand what the researcher is doing.
And everything over here is it's a matter of trust and how you gain trust. And I've been doing research with families and children who are unaccompanied minors, refugee children. And if I would have had a pile of forms to fill in, I would feel that would probably not be the best way of gaining trust, because the other persons, other adults they have been dealing with were policemen and people in the Finnish immigration services, very official authorities. And so it can be done step by step, but there has to be a clear indication that, yes, I would like to volunteer, and it's a volunteer decision. Now the new regulation is that, and also it seems to be in the government's proposal, the law should be passed in June, that children who are minimum 13 years old can state their own opinion. And 16 is the absolute kind of a minimum. Not necessarily if the child is 13, so that is. But
yeah.
Everybody needs to be sensitive and I think that would it harm the relationship in families? Do I still need to inform the parents or guardians that this child is taking part in the research? So everything needs to be kind of checked. In a way.
Sorry to comment, but for me, always having to sign those papers for my daughter, I try to ask her what. So it's more a burden to the parent because the parent won't be there and he won't have the consequences. So you have to take decisions on behalf of your children without the specific information, usually. And then with the consequences for the child, not for yourself. So it's kind of a, I would say it that way. So I would be more happy when the child would have the kind of the decision, at least in this teenage. So no longer the parents.
Sari, you said that the consent can be a plain yes or even whatever, but in the new regulation it says,
it can be documented. Yeah, the consent has to be documented, but
so
it doesn't need
to
be.
Document that
yeah.
You have agreement, or at least that is how I understood the new regulations.
Yeah.
So am I wondering, can I still use data where I already received the consent that I am allowed to record their voices?
Yeah, you are. Yeah, that's right.
Because
and if it's recorded, the consent is recorded, for example, that's consent.
Right.
Yeah.
And the other thing to add to that is, like, when I went to the refugee center, we had the written performance sense, we had the interpreters. It took a long time to translate and to assure them that this is not going to throw them in, over the movie or whatever. But a lot of them could barely sign their own names.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's the other issue. If you only have informed consent and they're not literate in any of their languages, this is oral consent is actually more valid, I would say, as long as it's recorded.
Yeah, because it has to be in the language the person can really have an access to and state that this is his or her will. For example, Nini would have good examples of how she has gained consent when she's been doing research among deaf refugees seeking asylum.
Could you give us some
example
about that? Thanks. Okay, yes, that's right. I'm doing interviews with deaf asylum seekers. So I have used this form which has pictures on it, and then there's a thumbs up picture showing that they can say yes to this, and a thumbs down means that they won't give their permission to use the data. And the pictures contain their pictures of me doing some writing work, and again there's thumbs up and thumbs down so they can mark what they want. And then I try to present in a picture there's me presenting the research. And then there's a picture if their faces can be shown in this kind of a situation. And again, thumbs up, thumbs down. But I used this one, but I also did an oral thing using sign language. So, and some of them went, they wanted to make clear that I wouldn't be mentioning their names or showing their faces. They really repeated these questions to understand what it meant, what they consented to. So it was really important to go again through what their content would mean.
When you recorded them, did you, of course, not the faces, right? But did you record their hand, them signing? No. Okay.
No, I didn't. Not with everyone. But I can't show the videos of them doing sign language because it's not, and I can't even show their hands because that would be, too identifiable.
Yeah, that's what I want.
So it's not enough to just blur their faces,
right.
But
yeah.
That's a good example of a special case where your data is solid and the consents are solid. So, but it doesn't. The research doesn't end or even begin with any types of consents. It doesn't make your research more ethical, I would say. You still need to, the whole responsibility is still on researchers' shoulders, not nobody else's, even though they would have given consent to to not be anonymized, but still the responsibility is always, always on researchers' side.
It says there that you have to use clear and plain language, which seems to me a contradiction, since you have to ask so many things, and the new regulations add up to the list, and so you have to keep a lecture or have like three papers, which nobody reads in the end. So I don't think it's kind of a... how do you think it's possible? Can you reduce the stuff you have to mention to those that are particularly relevant to that group, and you know that are of interest to that group, or do you just... is this just a play with words, that clear and plain language, when it means that it's three pages or half an hour lecturing that you have to...
There's
say
certainly
in this
a
situation.
Risk that there will be more detailed questions, and this we have noticed already in the ethical committee, and the new forms are under development, and we would like to have it as short as possible, and then probably to have a link to database, to a page where there's more detailed versions of it. But again, it depends on the persons who are we are working with. If they won't have an access to these, won't be able to read, for example, it would be better than to just save the time and go it through and just do it. I'm so sorry, but you have to do it. And why are we in this situation, I would ask? One of the reasons is that researchers haven't done their job properly. So people have been used in all sorts of different types of research designs, starting from medicine and going to psychology and social psychology and communication studies and in linguistics now. So we are in this situation because we haven't been so careful with people's own will and own choice and control over their own. So now we are here. And this is also an important thing, that whatever we are doing in the field, if we are doing, for example, ethnographic study or doing interviews or surveys, it always have some sort of... leaves a memory, a trace in the memory for people join the next research project or not. So, yes, it will be more complicated, but there are certain reasons why. And kind of if you look at the history, that we needed to have this Nuremberg Code, perhaps the most extreme example, but now we are in this where even these the whole life is more multi dimensional and very visual as well. So that's one of the reasons. So no laziness in this.
Yeah, but then of course it takes a lawyer to understand all that.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. No, it doesn't. Yeah.
One question. Thank you. One question of mine concerning consent, which sort of relates to the way I interpreted Asa's talk, has to do with what do we do with, how do we use things that happened to us along the road. For example, I was a student of Jeffers Schuren. Mm-hmm. Jeff never did any ethnographic field work, but all his papers are full with kind of small ethnographic observations, things that he noticed while he was sitting on an airplane. Mm-hmm. I've been using an example in my classes of, and I never use it for writing, but I use it for teaching, of me getting in a cab, and the cab asking where we're going, and he's saying, oh, just right, left. Mm-hmm. And then he was waiting until I gave the address, you know, which mm-hmm. illustrates many things. But this is something that happened to me. Mm-hmm. I never asked the guy permission, but I have been using it in my classes. Are we allowed to do that?
How would you think it would harm the person you had interaction with?
No, it wouldn't. Nobody would. It would just be a cab driver, even if I would mention the town.
Why wouldn't you use the data?
I don't know, because, I mean, the guy never gave consent for figuring in my paper. There was never informed. I mean, he just just something happened to me. I was walking somewhere and something happened, mm-hmm. and it left a trace, a mental trace, and I used that almost as in a kind of essayistic style, in a kind of Goffman style, for using using a kind of, and he became part of my research that way. That's kind of how I, and sometimes things happen to us along the way and we start collecting things, and that's how this happened to you, and then it, at what time does it become into a project? At one point, I started driving around on minibuses just to see things happen. Mm. Then I was already doing a kind of field research. Mm. Is that ethical?
Again, I would ask, would you harm the people that you would...
No, but again, there was no consent. I mean, they didn't...
But
there is non-participatory observations where if you can't... It's a cab driver.
But there are regulations, see there.
But it's about data, using it as
this
a research
data. What is data? You know, I think the main question...
I wouldn't consider that as the same as also data.
Sure.
I wouldn't put them even like to the same scale.
Where is the, of course, there is no such thing as a borderline, but where is this kind of... Where are the boundaries?
Work notes that mm-hmm. stuff that how what is the procedure for field work mm-hmm. notes mm-hmm. in this mm-hmm. setup? What would you say? What is the kind of mm-hmm. what is your position from ethics mm-hmm. on taking field notes? Can you take field notes anywhere Should without asking the people that you are taking field notes or not? What is your?
Shall I give just one extreme example and something I never used? I was in a sauna, public sauna. In a town somewhere, and there was a fight between a customer and a Moroccan guy who kept his swimming pants on. That's getting fairly close and getting fairly intimate, and it happened somewhere public. I remember at that time was in 15 years ago. I made notes of it with the idea of using it for a paper, but I never did. This is border. I mean, this is on the border of something that. Feel comfortable about using something. Mm.
Mm-hmm. Why would you do research about that?
Because I wasn't doing research, but it's kind of resonated with certain intellectual concerns that I was working, that kept me busy at that time. Mm. So it was something that I noticed because it resonated with things that were on my mind at that period. Mm. And I could have used it if I would have really turned that into writing. I might have.
Perhaps I need to be also.
There's water there as well.
Thank you. Okay, what I was thinking about if I do an interview and he or she is telling about someone else, and accidentally the third person who is not in fact. A part of my research becomes involved in my research and becomes a part of the research. So, for example, there's this one book that I'm involved in that I wasn't even aware that I would be included in a book. It's a research, report book. So, and I recognize myself in that book, even though I haven't been attending this research, but the researcher has been interviewing someone who is telling about meeting me in States or something like this. And so, and the informant in that study is telling a lot of things about me, and I can find that information about me in that study, even though I wasn't being interviewed. So that I sort of remember, it wasn't serious or anything, but I just felt slightly not that comfortable with that. So how to go about in future research if somebody is telling to me about a third person? What do I do with that information?
You don't do anything. The one also why this regulation is now about to be past also in Finland is that you need to protect the person's identity, and this is why we are doing this. I'm not so sure about the whether it's enough when you are, if you would be in sauna and there would be a Moroccan guy fighting with somebody else, if that would be the case. But in this case, for example, there are certain, it wouldn't be helping that she would be called Mira, for example, because that's pseudonyms. They are also, it's not enough for anonymizing data. But all the other traces that, okay, coming from Finland, highly educated, deaf Finnish sign language user, perhaps other three languages, about children, all those bits and pieces of traces that we are using, that comes, it becomes a data that we need to protect people. But it's not, I would say that it's not enough that if somebody is in the classroom, a random person or a taxi driver, especially if the person doesn't recognize him or herself. So that's perhaps the main issue. But it's not enough to anonymize that, saying that, yes, I'm doing research with my child and her name is Mila, let's say. That's not enough.
Yeah. Can I just comment on that? Because with this family, so what I did was to change names and so on and so forth, but you are completely right.
So how on earth could I anonymize this mother tongue? Because I'm actually examining the languages they're using.
Yeah.
So I have to mention in this case it was Dutch.
Yeah. And this is something that you need to negotiate with the people, that what is the level of anonymity. For example, when we were doing team ethnography in a reception center, we were obliged to actually name the reception center, but not the persons we were working with, except those who had a certain position, being like a director or vice director. So that was our mutual agreement, that we would say then that's a person who is working in this. But if you kind of add like, okay, man who came alone in his 20s and comes from this particular area, is Sunni, so all these tiny ingredients you can trace back. So that's not just a kind of a random encounter that you would have. I would have, for example, one example would have been that I was in a flea market in this particular reception center, having a very weird conversation with a woman who was utterly racist against other refugees. I wouldn't have been able to use this as data, even though she would have given the consent, because I thought that this would cause me more problems than the person's. So there are all sorts of choices you need to make. I didn't want to, at that point of the societal debates, I didn't want to raise the question of that refugees are racist also. And this comes to the research. Researcher positionality. And it seems to be that also what Srikant was saying, that kind of and it comes with the collaboration, but and co-production, but in all processes you as a researcher, you are there. And I like the title of this handbook. It's over there on the table. Why you are always part of the research process, even when you think you're not. It's a good thing for everyone to remind ourselves that what we are doing. Yes, and if I go on, there was another thing about collaboration and co-production, and this is something that really resonates what Osa was saying, that who are we working with, and what are the limits of collaboration, like having a conversation when having family sauna and somebody saying that, okay, I will tell you, you ask me, I tell you everything. And this is a situation perhaps happening to so many of us that, okay, you can ask me anything. And then the person can tell, let's start with first 15 minutes, the whole family history. And then we need to delete the first 15 minutes just to protect them from themselves, for starters. And this usually happens with adults, not so much with kids. But whose life is considered as data? And that key seemed to be a key question, especially with the unaccompanied teenagers we work with, who we ask them to take photographs about their lives and the meaningful moments when they were staying in a group home. It's like a children's home, and waiting when they were waiting for their decision of on their asylum case. And quite a few of these photos were selfies. So what to do with these? And we were so careful of not taking photos about themselves, showing anything, but they really wanted to do that. And who are actually the persons that we need to ask consent? They don't have parents here, they have guardians. There are certain regulations in the MICRIS, the Finnish Immigration Services website. But you don't even know how old they are, they don't know. So all these types of questions, and how to protect this person's in future, that if it might be really difficult for them if somebody would find out that they are in Finland. So all these, but also they are taking photos about us researchers, and we end up being on Facebook. Mm-hmm. And so that's why how we are revealed, and we are actually, we are part of their own life stories and data. What can we do with that? They don't need to ask any consents.
I'm going.
Just one quick issue there.
Yeah.
I mean, if they post your picture on Facebook, the implication is that it discloses their identity as participants in the research as well.
Mm. Yes.
So and that's their self.
Yeah.
I have totally the same experiences. I can tell you the details later. But in my case, for instance, they have been proud, or I don't know why, but that I have been in some place. And so they put on Facebook that this and that researcher was here. Because they are so proud of being researched. And so, of course, you don't make them to ask your consent on doing that because they are not researchers. So
I guess it links to one point that Srikant also made during the lecture, one of his talks when he was here, is that researchers are too vulnerable in the research process. Mm. So we shouldn't forget about that.
Yeah. I think it's good to start with this, I guess. It takes two to tango.
We had to, unfortunately, stop. However, just to let you know, June 11th, be there, be square. Social media and identity use in social media for running issues in marginalized communities and gaming and online. That will be June 6th. Secret will be with Silpa and Sam. And so if you know people who are in this area, please send a link to them once we get it. All these questions that we were asking on data collection, on data storage, on transportation of data, all of these kinds of things. So we might need two sessions, and it will be an EU person who was sat on the committee, so they will be able to ask very specific and direct questions, okay? Do you guys, now I think the one in June will probably be at noon, but do you guys want to change the time to like 10 o'clock?
in the future, not necessarily June, but I'm talking in the fall season. Is this noon time too difficult for everyone?
What is this, Wednesday?
It's like a Wednesday, we're thinking.
I guess there have been fairly many people.
So it's okay? This time is fine for everybody?
It's
just this week was crazy.
It's a bit bad for somebody, so.
Yeah, I think this week was just really crazy with all the things. And so those will be happening. And to let you know that also, if you're interested in the kind of research that co-production and arts-based and collaborative, we will be setting up, there is a network that's from SIG, from
Isla,
that exists right now called the Creative Inquiry Network. And we're going to be setting up the Nordic component of it. And if you're interested in ethnographic research, arts-based, collaborative, co-participatory, co-production, we'll let you know and we'll send you links and stuff. And with that regard, there will be training in the area of co-production coming up in the end of November. I'll give you more specific dates with Kate Paul, who works with, she's done many, many longitudinal research questions, and she prefers to work with not white researchers. She wants diverse teams. Teams that are not just researchers, but teams that are in the field, social activists, policymakers, community workers, social workers, instead of just having the traditional research team. Research funding in the UK, and I think Finland will start to follow as well, will be starting to put forth this, that you must have a more diverse team. You can't just have researchers on your team for funding. So just to let you know, she'll be able to address those issues and those things in the future. So thank you guys for all coming, and great questions. We didn't need Johanna to ask all the controversial questions. We met Sigrid and Petri and Dimitri. Thanks.